everybody. This is Henrik Palmgren, and you're listening to Red Ice Radio. We're based out of Sweden, Scandinavia. And if you're new to the program, you can find more shows that we do and all the other info at redicecreations.com. You can subscribe to our RSS feeds, check out our news headlines, and connect with our social networking sites as well. Richard C. Hoagland is a former NASA consultant and former science advisor to Walter Cronkite and CBS News during the Apollo missions to the moon. He is the author of two best-selling books on his 40 years of intensive research into the possibility of a former ancient solar system-wide high-tech civilization. He returns to discuss the fascinating symbols, rituals, and mysteries surrounding Comet Ison. Ison has been billed as a potential comet of the century, with some experts saying that it could blaze as bright as the full moon around the time of its close solar approach in late November here coming up. Before we get into Ison, however, we're going to talk about some of the precursors to this event, like Comet Elenin and some other connections as well. So stay with us for much more. And welcome back, Mr. Hoagland. Good to talk to you again. I hope you're doing well. Thanks for coming back on the program.
Well, Henrik, it's been too long.
It has been. How long has it been?
Too long.
A year? Yeah, I got
no, it's been at least a year.
I think so. That's,
you know, you guys never call. People say to me, hey, you should be doing Henrik's show. And I say, well, they don't call.
We always want to have you on, Richard. It's always a blast. And I'm so glad that you're back with us again. Let me see when you were with us last.
Yeah, years ago. While you're looking up, I'll tell a little story.
February 24th. So it's not that long ago.
Well, but it's almost a year.
Yeah.
It's almost December, and that's almost, you know.
It's a good gestation period, let me put it that way.
Oh, I like that. Is it 9 months?
Something like that, yeah.
240 days?
Yeah, I think so.
Amazing. Okay.
All right, but well, let's just dive into it here, Rich. I mean, it, almost now, as we are doing this recording here on the 15th, and this is going to be available on the 18th of November, Comet Ison is pretty much almost now visible to the naked eye. Tell us everything we need to know about Comet Ison.
Oh my God, how long do we have?
how long you want?
Well, let me start with the high points. We've been watching this thing since the Russians discovered it about a year ago. And even then, it was touted as the comet of the century. I've been involved in several comets of the century that turned out to be real disastrous fizzles. Many, many years ago, when I was at the Hayden Planetarium in New York, we had a comet discovered by a Czech astronomer named Kohoutek, who actually I was able to have lunch with some months later, which was kind of interesting. And then I borrowed a major ocean liner and chased Comet Kohoutek to South America. The ocean liner happened to be the QE2, the Queen Elizabeth II, and I put a whole bunch of interesting people on board, including Carl Sagan and his wife, and we did seminars. I mean, I kind of invented the whole seminar at sea thing back then in the early 70s. And we had a wonderful time. We saw the comet. We had an incredible experience. We had the wonderful shipboard camaraderie that is very much akin to what someday it will be like when we can all, you know, travel on spaceships to the planets and to the stars, but you can only do on ocean liners right now. And for people in cities, it was a big dud, because it was certainly not the comet of the century, but for us at sea, it was incredibly beautiful and visible, and I did star parties with Ken Franklin, who was the head of the Hayden Planetarium at that time where I worked. And we'd gather people around, and we would, in the tennis courts up on the upper decks of the QE2, we would point out constellations, and we were going far enough south to South America, actually,
mm-hmm.
that we were able to see Alpha Centauri rising on the horizon, glittering the closest star to the solar system, and Centaurus, the constellation, and, you know, the Southern Cross and all that. So, it was a really heady time, but it kind of conditioned me that when the media, when the press says anything is going to be the comet of the century, beware. Run like hell, because it's probably not going to come true. Now, we've been watching Ison, which, as I said a few moments ago, was discovered by the Russians using an international network of telescopes That's where the ISON acronym comes from. And it was projected way back then. There were stories, which you can easily Google and find, comet of the century, brighter than the full moon, et cetera,
mm-hmm.
as it whipped around the sun. And we've been watching this thing as it's been falling in toward the center of the solar system. Its orbit is inclined about 62 degrees, meaning it's 30 degrees off the plane of the planets. Its obliquity, which is the tilt from the North Ecliptic Pole, is about 62 degrees. So it's 28 degrees and change tilted to the rest of the planet. So as it's coming in, it's sailing far above, million miles above the orbit plane of, you know, Mars and Earth and Venus and Mercury, etc. And a few weeks ago, on October 1st, it crossed 6.5 million miles almost directly above the North Pole of Mars. And that was the night that I did about a one-hour update for Art Bell's new show, Dark Matter, which unfortunately is no longer with us and thereby hangs a tale, and it's not a commentary tale, it's a soap opera, actually. And then it continued to fall in, you know, crossing the Earth's orbit a couple, 3 days ago. It's now well inside the orbit of Venus, radially looking down on the solar system from far above, and in a few more days it will cross the orbit of Mercury, and in less than 2 weeks, on the 28th of November, on Thanksgiving Day, it will whip around the sun closer than the sun's diameter to the photosphere before heading back out into interstellar space, because this is what's called a parabolic object. This is an object that's come from so far out there, literally maybe halfway between us and the nearest star, Alpha Centauri, although not in that direction, that it's the first time it's ever visited the solar system, and it will be the last, because even though it's interacting with the gravity field of the solar system, and mainly Jupiter and Saturn, which are the big guys that gravitationally tug on these objects as they come in, it will not lose enough energy to remain in a small orbit. It will all go out almost as far as it came in from, if that's an appropriate grammatical construction, and we'll never see it again. But as it is passing through the inner solar system, it's not only been watched with everybody and anybody in the media posting almost daily stories, but it's been projected to become, as I said earlier, the comet of the century, and it has fallen far short of the numerical projections based on distance from the sun and the light curve that it should have in terms of brightness as at this moment.
Mm-hmm.
However, I need to caveat that statement by saying that in the last two nights, suddenly, for no apparent reason, because it's only incrementally closer to the sun each night, it suddenly brightened by a factor of 16 times compared to just a couple, 3 days ago. And whether this brightening will continue and it will begin to really become spectacular and visible in the pre-dawn darkness about an hour before sunrise, if you get up anywhere in the United States, actually anywhere in the Northern Hemisphere, about an hour before dawn and look east, you will see it. And at the moment, it's only really visible in binoculars, but if it continues to brighten as dramatically over the next few days as it has over the last couple, 3 days, then by Monday, the 18th, when this airs, it could become a very easily visible naked eye object in the pre-dawn skies looking east about an hour before sunrise. And that would be really cool, because this comet has so many weirdnesses and rituals and hidden agendas surrounding it, and that's what we're going to take the majority of the time that we have to spend together trying to unravel and lay out, so that people who aren't used to dealing in this arcane realm of ritual, symbolic, sacred mystery school ritual, will get a feeling for what we're talking about.
Very exciting. It's always a lot of a lot of fun listening to this and hearing more about the connections, of course, that that you make in when these, you know, events come around, Richard. And if we for a moment here, though, can talk a little bit about the brightness increase. I believe the same basically happened with Comet Holmes. I believe even the same happened with Elenine before that suddenly kind of withered away, of course, and just disappeared. But what makes this sudden just brightness come along on these comets?
Well, that all depends on your comet model. As you know, for the last 30, 40 years, since Fred Whipple, who was an astronomer at the Smithsonian Astrophysical Observatory in Cambridge, Massachusetts, created what's called the icy snowball model or the dirty snowball model, comets have been viewed as bergy bits of ices that congealed and froze in the formation process of the planets and the entire solar system about 4.5 billion years ago. And since most of the universe is made up of lighter gases that condense at moderate temperatures into ices and not of solid stuff like rocks and metals and the things that we're familiar with here on the Earth, the solar system in the far, far distant cold reaches, billions of miles from the sun, is supposed to be filled with these little bergy bits of ice with frozen carbon dioxide and frozen carbon monoxide and frozen ammonia and methane and water ice with a scattering of dust, heavy elements mixed in. And when these objects randomly come closer to the sun, so the solar heat warms them, just like being outside on a warm summer day, these ices that have been in perpetual darkness and bitter cold just above absolute zero, billions of miles out there, well beyond Pluto, you know, as I said, maybe halfway to the nearest stars, which is 4 light years away, they warm up. And because they're so tiny in this model, they're like little icebergs. They're about the size of icebergs, a few miles across, as we've now imaged them with spacecraft. They warm up and they melt. The problem is, it's not really a problem, it's a fact, that they're melting in a vacuum and they're melting on objects that are basically zero gravity. I mean, what's the gravity of an iceberg 3 or 4 miles across? It's 0.0000001, something like that,
mm-hmm.
compared to Earth, which would be 1 on that scale. So that means that when you warm these gases up and they go from being ice cold, steel hard, rock hard chunks of frozen material, and they vaporize in a vacuum, you know, in a real, real hard vacuum, they don't go through a liquid process. They flash directly into vapor, and they escape because the gravity of the body that's melting under them is basically zero. So that's where you get these fluffy, coma, long, streaming, tail-like objects, because the coma and the tail around a comet is basically the comet vaporizing. And that newly born atmosphere of gases, a variety of compositions, ammonia, methane, water vapor, and then various ions and radicals, as the sunlight breaks those molecules apart, they can't stay stuck to the comet. They just leave because the gravity field is essentially zero.
Yeah.
So that's why you see them sailing through the dark in these wonderful images, or in telescopic views, or in pictures of NASA releases from Hubble, having this really kind of fluffy, hazy, ball-like head, and then this long, streaming tail, because it's basically the comet disintegrating, vaporizing in a vacuum, subliming into nothing, and drifting away into space because of the lack of gravity to keep those warmed gases clinging close to the object. And that's what makes them so spectacular and also so very, very evanescent. I mean, the density of a cometary nuclear, of a cometary coma or tail is like a few molecules per cubic centimeter. which is millions of times less dense than the atmosphere that you and I are breathing right now. So even though in 1910, when the Earth crossed through the tail of Halley's Comet, a very famous comet, and the press was all agog with stories of people are going to be gassed to death by the cyanogen and cyanide in the tail of Halley's Comet. Quick, buy your comet pills or rent a trip in a submarine to stay underwater for the weeks while the comet passes
right.
So you don't die. Those stories were just basically yellow journalism. That cannot happen because the density of these gases, which look so incredibly spectacular on the images or even through a telescope, it's basically a vacuum you're looking at. So there's no real physical interaction with the Earth. And when it comes to the fear porn mongers, of which this comet apparition, Ison coming around the sun, has spawned its own little crop of doomsday sayers. I mean, I get the emails daily, and if it weren't so tragic, I'd be laughing. Because these people are really putting the fear of the cosmos into so many people deliberately by spreading outright lies and deceptions, to say nothing of the huge number of idiotic and ridiculous and really pernicious YouTube videos, you know, saying that everything bad under the sun is going to be attached to this comet going around the sun, and we're all doomed, and the Earth is going to be destroyed, and the rocks are going to rain down, and it's all total BS.
Yeah, it's interesting that doomsday cults seem to spring up around these events. We know about Marshall Applewhite and his little cult there many years ago. There was even a church now set up in Russia, I believe, that started to worshiping the comet that came in there a couple of years ago. There's got to be something more to this, though. It's got to be a stigma involved in something that has an ancient memory here in terms of doom and gloom that is awakened in the human psyche or something, right?
Well, long before we had institutions like the CIA or the KGB or the NSA, or the concept of black ops became, you know, part of the conversation, comets have had a really bad rap going back historically hundreds of years. And the late Tom Van Plandern and I, you know who he was,
yep,
right?
Yep.
He's probably been a guest on your show when he was still with
Unfortunately
us.
Not. No, we never got him. No, we never got him. He passed away.
Insane.
Yeah, it is.
Well, for those who don't know, Tom and I were very, very, very old colleagues and friends going back decades to when we helped save the Voyager spacecraft together against the onslaught of President Reagan's budget director, David Stockman. This is back in the 80s, early 80s. And Tom used to be the chief astronomer at the U.S. Naval Observatory in Washington, D.C. And along with a guy named, I think, Harrington, he was the one who discovered the first object to be circling Pluto, the moon Charon. So he was a really august, well-educated, hailed, you know, graduate, mainstream PhD astronomer, who just happened to have one little quirk. And that is that Tom, when he looked at the orbits of comets, particularly long-period comets, came to the conclusion that comets and the asteroids, as totally divergent from the current mainstream model, that they are remnants, as I said a few minutes ago, of the formation processes that created the whole solar system, the planets included. Tom came to the conclusion, based on his expertise, which was in celestial mechanics, which is the mathematics of orbits and how things move in space, whether they're natural or artificial. He came to the conclusion that the comets and the asteroids were the result of a gargantuan set of explosions of planets previously destroyed through internal processes, releasing enormous amounts of energy and blowing them to kingdom come, and that the comets that we see and the asteroids that we see are the remnants of these extraordinary planetary explosions billions of years in the past history of the solar system. Now, to put it mildly, this did not make Tom the best friend of a lot of mainstream astronomers in and outside of NASA.
Right.
He became somewhat ostracized.
Yeah.
Which didn't faze him. He started something called the Meta Research Foundation, and you can go to Google and Google, you know, metaresearch.org, I think.
Yeah.
And you'll find all of his papers and all of his expertise and all of the conversations and all of his documentation. He wrote a brilliant book, which has a long title, which escapes me, but in the title is Comets, Dark Matter, Planetary Bodies, or something like that. Just Google, you know, Tom Van Flandern book, and you'll get that title. And that's available still. It's being sold. He was a very visionary synoptic thinker, and it's such a tragedy that Tom is no longer with us, because he would be having the proverbial field day in seeing what this object, ISON, is doing, and some of the projections, like ours at Enterprise, as to what it could do in the next few days and weeks. Because unlike most of these objects, ISON is a part of a rare and special class where the evidence, the data that I've been quietly accumulating now for months, says pretty unequivocally, and this is going to make a lot of my skeptic friends out there really unhappy and tearing their hair out and throwing things at the wall and all that, or beating their computer into a pulp because I'm saying it through the speakers, that ISON is not a totally natural object.
Mm-hmm.
Someone has been and is going to increasingly tinker with it to change it into a symbol of a paradigm shift that's coming.
Now, before we get into the esoteric occult signaling that goes on in the subtext around the events of this comet that you said before kind of trickles down from the rituals of the mystery schools, NASA wrote, if Comet ISON survives its trip around the sun, there's a good chance that it will be incredibly bright and easily visible with the naked eye in the northern hemisphere in early December. But the question here then is, before we get into the meat of this, Richard, do you believe the comet will meet the same fate as Elenin and wither away in the current solar cycle and somewhat activity that's been going on here in the last couple of months now? What's the prospect?
Well, I would contest one thing you just said, which is that Elenin withered away. My model, based on, again, evidence and data, and what we're going to do, folks, just so you know, is we're going to post a series of images so that each of these sections we can, you know, associate actual graphics and images, so when you get to listen to this, you'll have a picture to actually refer to. We found, just in the couple of 3 days before Elenin, which was the last great comet that was heralded, and particularly made the butt of all kinds of fear porn by the doomsday mongers a couple years ago, we noticed on the imagery that was being sent out by NASA the formation of an extraordinary three-dimensional tetrahedron around the cometary nucleus. And I posted this on the COAST website at the time with an appropriate caption. We will take that image and we'll put it over here on red ice so you can see that, in fact, it looked like someone, because Elenin also was an artificially tinkered with object, not just a natural comet. And if you want, we can get into why I can make that statement with great certitude. Somebody did something that basically screened it from view, like raised shields, so that it became invisible while it was doing what we have modeled it may have been intended to do as part of this larger picture, this larger plan, using these cosmic objects that I'm going to talk about at some length over the next hour or so.
Speculation then, where is it now, Elenin?
Well, Elenin was on the same kind of parabolic trajectory that ISON is, meaning that it whipped around the sun, and if there were no course changes, which I don't think there were, and that we could see none in the data, it's somewhere out beyond the orbit of Jupiter heading far, far out, and it won't be back for maybe 5,000-10,000 years. It also had an incredibly long orbit with a very long period of millions of years. But unlike Ison, it was coming in much more in the plane of the planets and in a retrograde orbit, so that it appeared to be interacted with gravitationally, so that a lot of the energy that it came in with, it didn't leave with, so that it's probably going to come back. But I think 10,000 years is a little long for us to wait around. So for all intents and purposes, it came and went. But it did not disappear, because I have imagery after its drop-dead date from amateurs that clearly saw this tetrahedral formation around it, created in the gases of the solar wind, well after it was said to have disappeared. And so that's more media hype and more, you know, just get people to lose interest, and you tell them something's no longer visible, most people won't go out and even try to see it.
I got that. Now, so would you say that ISON now then is a continuation of the signaling that Elenin initiated, if you will?
Precisely. And you're very, very sharp to pick up on that, because when I did COAST and I talked about Elenin, and I did some private conferences where I laid out the entire case, I said that Elenin was kind of like John the Baptist, which is a very strange metaphor, but people who are religious and Christians will know what I mean. John the Baptist was the forerunner of Christ. He was the town crier. He was the guy that said, you know, the big thing is coming, the big thing is coming. Well, Elenin, looked at in this model, was the forerunner of the big thing, which could be ISON. And it was designed to get people, again, who know how to look and know how to see and how to interpret data, to basically pay attention, and everybody else to simply ignore it and go away or get swallowed up by all the fear porn mongers. That's why I said that even though comets have had historically a bad rap, and they're looked at as objects of doom historically, which may go all the way back to Tom Van Flandern's work, which is that if you blow a planet up and the survivors ultimately wind up here on Earth and they go through endless reincarnation cycles, we're really encompassing a lot here, aren't we?
It's good stuff.
That there will be some deep cultural, subjective, subconscious memory that comets are associated with the thing that literally destroyed the planet you used to live on.
Yeah.
And so culturally you'll have that mnemonic memory very deep, deep, deep inside, and you'll look at these things with fear as opposed to an aggrandizing anticipation of something good happening. And that's what I think that these fear porn mongers are playing off of, which is this deep subconscious meme that comets originated in catastrophe, and in the ensuing millions of years, when some of them have impacted other bodies in the solar system, they create catastrophic effects, and if the object is big enough, they can wipe out whole ranges of species, a la the dinosaurs, etc. So, yeah, when you look at the sky and you see a comet, if there's this incredible, long, millions of years old, buried, you know, subconscious memory from incarnations of consciousness, human, from life to life to life to life to life over millions of years. I mean, this is a pretty big concept to get our mind around. Then, yeah, there'd be a predisposition to see all these things in a very negative light. And that's what I think the current doomsayers, the fear porn mongers, as I call them, are consciously, deliberately playing upon. And they're trying to change what I believe in our model is a portent of stunning positive change, a positive paradigm shift that someone is using these celestial objects as portents to signify symbolically in their religion, because we're dealing basically with an ancient religion. Even though they're using modern technological toys to make it come true, it's a religion, it's a cosmic connection of our relationship to everything, to God, to the all, to the cosmos, to creation. The fear porn mongers really, really are focusing on creating as much fear and loathing of these coming celestial symbols as possible. And the reason is very simple. Because in the whole hyperdimensional physics model that I've been working on for decades and that you and I have discussed here over many, many years, I now can demonstrate that in the physics that we can measure, in this larger cosmic drama, what we expect, what we feel, what we project can really affect what we get. So if you put the negative spin on a positive event, you can actually change the future so you get a negative outcome from what otherwise would have been a positive event. And that's what their agenda is. And that's why you see this dripping fear porn all over the web, from direct emails to the YouTube videos to the Yahoos who know nothing about celestial mechanics and nothing about the real wonders that these significant symbolic objects could mean. Their job is to make people as afraid as possible. Be very, very afraid is their message.
All right, so let's try to get to some of the points here, some of the deeper or bigger picture subtextual signals that you've picked up on in this when it comes to this comment, Richard.
Well, let me try to, again, I'm speaking as if nobody in the audience knows anything. Because this is such an arcane field, and if I hadn't spent 30-some years studying it with various colleagues like, you know, Bruce De Palma and Tom Van Plander and my co-author Mike Barra on Dark Mission, I wouldn't have any basis to talk like this. But I know I can incontrovertibly prove that, for instance, our space agency has a public image, a public face that we all get to see, and a very private side that very few people get to see, let alone even understand, which Mike and I covered in great detail in Dark Mission. There is a whole ritual side to the National U.S. Space Agency, NASA, which comes from the Masonic tradition. A lot of the people inside NASA, or astronauts, or mission people, or program people, or administrators, up to and including the major administrator that John Kennedy appointed as his second in command at NASA when he took the presidency in 1960, James Webb, was a 33rd degree Mason. And what we're seeing in these arcane rituals, which I have documented now going back decades, first in The Monuments of Mars, A City on the Edge of Forever, which was my first book on all these hidden discoveries, followed up by Dark Mission, The Secret History of NASA, with Mike Barra, which is my second opus magnum on this hidden side of a taxpayer-supported agency, is that there's a huge contingent of people and planning that goes into making missions happen during appropriate ritual times, dates, hours, when celestial objects are at key angles to each other, above or below the Earth horizon, above and below various key sacred sites on the planet, like the Giza Plateau, where the pyramids are, above and below the horizon of Cydonia on Mars, which is a crucial linchpin connecting the events in the ancient solar system with the events on Earth by way of the face on Mars, which the Russians call the Martian Sphinx, with the terrestrial Sphinx located on the Giza Plateau in Egypt, and on and on and on and on. So obviously, in the short time we have together, I can't possibly document this decades of research. That's what the books are for. So go get Monuments of Mars and read it, and go get Dark Mission, Secret History of NASA, and read it, and you will see the foundation for the things that I'm going to say this afternoon that I cannot document in great detail because we just don't have the time. But the bottom line is, our so-called National Civilian Scientific Space Agency, NASA, is up to its proverbial eyebrows in secret, arcane, celestial rituals in service to an ancient Egyptian religion, which venerated these constellations and their mythologies and associated stories as fact that is only meant for the chosen few and not for, as the phrase used to go, the great unwashed. So even though they conduct their activities according to these ancient rituals, which show up in the celestial alignments, which of course they can't hide, they will absolutely deny to their dying breath that they're doing anything but pursuing metonymic, modern, 21st century science, when in fact the numbers, and it all comes down to the numbers, prove what they're really doing.
How early in the process did you notice when it came to come to the discovery of ISIL? Was it pretty much from the get-go back in September 2012?
No. This is much older. You know, I've been looking at this now for, I'm trying to think of the first time that I really started to think about the ritual side of NASA.
Oh, yeah. Sorry to interrupt. Of course. No, that I understand. I'm just talking about ISON specifically when the connection
well,
there.
Well, remember, ISON was preceded by Al-Anin.
Yeah.
And I said a moment ago that the way you know this is going on is the way you know in any science that something is going on. You follow the trail of the numbers. You can't lie about the numbers. The numbers stand still. The numbers are irrefutable. I'll give you an example. We have now probably a million amateur astronomers all over the world, give or take. And a lot of those amateurs have very high-tech equipment. Computerized go-to telescopes. They've got computers to process images and data. They have photometers. They have spectrometers. And at the very least, they have telescopes that they can use to look through, and those telescopes more and more are run by little computers that basically you put in the little, you know, window, the thing you want to look at, and the telescope, when you punch the button, automatically points in the direction of the thing you want to look at. You don't even now, if you don't know what you're doing, have to set it up properly. You simply tell the computer, I want to see Venus, you know, after sunset. And the computer, whir, bang, bang, clank, clank, will point in the direction of Venus, and you put your eye to the eyepiece, and lo and behold, there is Venus right in the center of the field of view. It kind of takes the joy out of amateur astronomy out of it for some of us.
Right.
But for most people, it's had the same effect on astronomy that the Internet has had on communications or Facebook has had on, you know, social relationships. It has democratized the sky. Now, what is the basis of telling your telescope, and at some level now the programs, the apps are written, so you literally don't even have to type into a window. You just say to the telescope, find me Saturn, and it will, which is amazingly cool when you consider how ancient astronomy is. The basis of all that, of course, is the numbers. Because if the computer in the go-to telescope that the average amateur is buying from Celestron or one of the other big companies doesn't have the right coordinates in it so that it can basically point the telescope where you ask it to point it, you'll point it and you won't see anything, right?
Yeah.
So the coordinates have got to be correct. NASA can't cheat and give out a set of fake coordinates for anything, because amateurs will quickly, immediately find them out and get very, very angry and will storm the barricades and telling them, why did I pay hundreds of dollars for this damn telescope when you're giving me the wrong information as to where the thing was? So there is a center at the Smithsonian at Harvard called the Minor Planets Center, which takes sightings from professional and amateur astronomers all over the world of these celestial objects, be it asteroids or planets or comets, and puts them into a common database and then puts them out through the Internet. Thank God for the Internet! And you can download at the touch of a button. I downloaded the latest coordinates for ISON just before we went on the air. So that tonight when I go out to look at it, I'll know exactly where to look within fractions of a second of arc, which is a tiny, 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 tiny angle in the sky. The reason all this is important is because the baseline is, even though we've been telling everybody for years NASA's faking all kinds of data, which they are, it's not the data on where things are. If they tried to fudge that, they'd quickly be found out because a howling group of amateur astronomers would totally, instantly catch them lying to them because they wouldn't be able to see what they're pointing their telescopes at. So the one thing we can count on are the coordinates and the orbits and the trajectories of these objects in the solar system. I hope that's really, really, really clear because it's the basis for what I'm going to say next.
Sure, sure, yeah.
Okay, so we agree they can't lie about that.
I agree.
So what I did when Elenine made its appearance, I got very, very suspicious when the Russian who announced its discovery, a guy named Elenine, who turns out was not a an astronomer at all. He was a mathematician at a private institute outside of Moscow, and he gave some presentations, and then he disappeared from public view. During the whole Elenine passage, no mainstream media could ever reach him for an interview. Now, what's interesting is that this kind of confounds human nature. In the astronomical world, through the International Astronomical Union, the IAU, the convention is that a comet is named automatically by the guy or gal who finds it, and you can either choose to have it named after you personally. I mean, that's incredible ego boo, right? How many people on the planet get to have something that's celestial and eternal named after them between the time they're born and the time they die? That's got to be the ultimate ego experience, right? Immortality writ large.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Elenine refused to talk about his comet in the media. Now, wait a minute. Isn't that kind of weird? Wouldn't you think that this guy, this he was like in his 20s, beginning his career, these things can make your professional career.
Mm-hmm.
When you discover something that is of that importance, that you get to name it after yourself, or you can name it after the computer telescope network that you use, or the observatory. I mean, it's under the discretion of the discoverer how to name it, as are asteroids. Asteroids, if you find an asteroid, you get to name it. Now, asteroids, it's a little different. They're not named after the guy who finds them, but the guy or gal have to pick another name. So there are literally asteroids that have been named after girlfriends and ships and famous books,
right,
and movies,
yep,
and people. But you can't name an asteroid after yourself. In other words, if Hoagland went out tonight and found an asteroid, it would not be called Hoagland. I'd have to give it, I'd probably give it Robin's name. Why not? Put it in the star. But if I found a comet, you know, yeah, I have a total right to name it Comet Hoagland. It actually has a nice ring to it, don't you think?
In
my very busy career, I've been about to find a comet.
Yeah, that would be great.
So when Elenine refused to become a public figure, to talk about an object which had been on, I mean, did you know anybody who wasn't talking about Elenine a couple of years ago?
Yeah, it was pretty busy, yeah.
It was huge. Mainstream media, you know, we were on Coast all the time talking about it. There were a zillion YouTube videos, 99% of them total crap, you know, with all the fear porn. And Elenine himself doesn't want to appear on television and talk about and correct all the misimpressions to basically damp down all the stupid fear porn and talk about the real science and wonder of discovery. I mean, there's a whole story around comets that you could, you know, if you were of a mainstream point of view, you could easily spin, but not to want to be on global television talking about the thing that is your claim to fame, that right there struck me as really, really weird.
You're right, right.
Just from a human point of view.
Mm.
And being, as I said to Art the other night, I said, you have ruined me forever. You've made me conspiratorial. You've made me look under the hood of everything that happens, so I don't accept the first superficial explanation, you know, which, of course, all of us should be doing. We should all be asking questions, because we live in this mainstream media created virtual reality. God, I'm sounding like David Icke. But it's true.
He's right,
He's totally, totally correct. Now, I don't go as far as to say that, you know, the presenters are shape-shifting reptilians, you know, but everybody is entitled to their little quirks, and I'll give David that. But he's totally right when he says that we live in a virtual reality world where most of people's reality is created for them and fed to them through television and now the Internet, unless you really, really, really want to find your own truth and do the digging and do the comparison of sources and all that. So I'm looking at the Elohim thing, and I'm saying, from a human point of view, this just is weird. Why doesn't the guy want to take his 15 minutes and do something positive for the field? I mean, astronomers are constantly saying that we need more public attention on cosmic things to get people ultimately to fund the national space programs to go and find more important cosmic things, right?
Mm-hmm.
So why wouldn't the guy, as part of the state system in Russia, which has a taxpayer-supported space program, just like the Americans, why wouldn't he want to do not just Russian television? He did one interview early on for Russian television. That was it. Nothing else. And it wasn't available to the Argentinians or the Japanese, who are huge on this stuff, or all the American networks as it got bigger and bigger and the, you know, fear porn got weirder and weirder. You know, Elohim was conspicuous with his absence. So I started thinking, is it possible that all this fear porn is in fact being designed to counteract something that is inherent in the Elohim apparition, which they're trying to stamp out? You know the old joke about stamping out burning ducks? In a way of overwhelming public perception with a negative, when in fact Elohim might be carrying a positive message. And how would that message be carried? Well, obviously, you're familiar with the Hopi prophecy about the blue kachina, right? And the big brilliant blue thing that's supposed to appear in the sky right after or right before the huge change of paradigm, the change of the world age, the shift of global cycles, the change of consciousness, all of that. So it's supposed to be in Hopi tradition, which I learned very, very early on when I got to be friends with Grandfather Thomas Banyaka and actually walked with him and spoke with him when they were presenting the Hopi elders back in 1992 at the United Nations. They presented this message from the earth that he'd been trying since the 1940s to get to present to the folks in the House of Micah, as they call the UN, because it's a big building made of glass, right?
Right.
So I'm kind of up on the whole Hopi prophecy, which is why I got really intrigued with Obama when he was running for president in 2008. He was quoting Hopi prophecy. Did you know that?
No.
Yes. I can. We'll put on the website, as part of the Hoagland page, we'll put Obama's Hopi prophecy quotes, which is why I got really intrigued with Obama and why he enters this story, a la Hyson, in a little while. There is an Obama connection coming that I can prove. Totally, totally prove. So anyway, I'm looking at the Elohim thing, and I'm saying, okay, something doesn't make sense. So I started looking at the only way that Elohim, if it was the blue kachina, the star of the Hopi prophecy, could carry the message, which is in the numbers. Remember, numbers are a code. You know, there are 26 letters in the alphabet, right? So in the Jewish tradition, there's a thing called gematria, where you assign numbers to the letters, right? So there's a transposition back and forth, and there are all kinds of secret codes. Have you had Stan Tenen on from the Nehru Foundation?
No, but we talked about gematria that many times,
Oh, you've got to get Stan on.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And if he's giving you a hard time, I'll give him a call, because Stan cracked the Jewish gematria code and it turns out to be ultimately all about the hyperdimensional physics that you and I have discussed many, many, many times. The first chapter of Genesis is really a metaphorical, lyrical, poetic translation in story of the fundamental mathematics underlying hyperdimensional physics itself. And that is an amazingly cool story, and Stan used to be the one to tell it. Stan, by the way, is a former physicist. He worked for the Sylvania Corporation before he got totally into his own religious heritage. Anyway, I'm kind of jumping around here because I want to give you why I started looking at the numbers attached to L&E.
Right.
Now, there are only a few numbers that can be attached to any celestial object, right?
Right.
Such as its brightness, such as the orbit parameters of its orbit, which are defined in terms of its angle to the plane of the planets, mostly the Earth, called the ecliptic, the date of its passage around the sun, the distance from the sun of its passage. In other words, we're not dealing with an infinite number of numbers. We're dealing with a very tiny handful of numbers out of an infinite set of possibilities. Unlike the planets, which go around the sun in kind of ordered orbits, you know about Bode's Law?
Yeah, I do.
Which is a mathematical formula applied to the spacing of the planets, from Mercury to, I was going to say Pluto, but they've kind of, you know, discarded Pluto as a planet.
To the side, yeah.
Yeah, but it's still a planet. Come on. Give me a break. Politics notwithstanding, Pluto's a planet. The point is that there is a pattern, a regular pattern, to the orbits of the planets in the solar system. And no mainstream astronomers have figured out why that pattern exists. We have, and our colleagues and others over the years, that it has to somehow be a residuum of the mathematical spacing in the original nebula, which had harmonics in it, sound waves, causing shifts in gravity and spacing and distance and velocity and all that, and you wind up with a harmonic pattern that is left in the orbits of the planets after the gas and dust that formed them disappears. So it's kind of like the tracer of the original conditions that led to the formation of the solar system, fossilized in the orbits of these big, massive things we call planets.
Right.
We're standing on one right now, or sitting, that's 8,000 miles across and weighs, you know, 1.5 times 10 to the, what is it, 20th tons or something? I mean, it's a huge number, incomprehensible number. So it hasn't moved much in the history of the solar system, whereas the dust and gas all went away. And the spacing, the harmonic spacing, which is called Bode's Law, encodes mathematically the conditions of the original solar system creation. That's the idea. That's the model, right? The same thing does not apply to comets. Why? Because comets are so tiny and they have so little mass that all kinds of forces, including when they evaporate gases, they can jet themselves into different orbits, just like, you know, using a rocket pack. So that when you get an orbit of a comet, it's not forever and ever and ever. The orbit actually can slowly change, depending upon whether the gas jets that are erupting from the surface due to the solar heating spurt in the direction of the sun, or spurt in the direction of the orbit, or spurt behind, so that these jets can accelerate or decelerate or change planes somewhat of orbit parameters for comets, so that a comet's orbit can constantly, within pretty tight limits, be changing, particularly as they go around the sun and they get hotter and hotter and the ejection of gases becomes more and more violent. They actually operate like little rockets in Newton's third law. So I looked at the orbit parameters of L&E, and it was like, oh my God, those numbers should not exist. And without going through all the details, I'll just tell you that all of the key numbers associated with L&E that is swept through the solar system, starting with its brightness at plus 19.5 magnitude, were all hyperdimensionally significant numbers. And by that I mean they were 33s and 19.5s, and they came closest to the various planets, including the Earth, when Elenine was at a key angle to the pyramids of Giza, like 19.5 degrees above the horizon at dawn. In other words, so many repeating, crucially significant hyperdimensional numbers attached to the orbit of this little object that everybody else thought was natural. But it got to the point where it was absurd and ridiculous to consider that Elenine was anything but an artificially tinkered with object. Remember, you can take a natural object and make it artificial by putting it on a specific course,
mm-hmm.
by giving it a direction, by giving it a nudge at the right time, at the right speed, etc. And so you get all these, you know, other parameters falling out very neatly by just adjusting its orbit. It doesn't have to be a mechanical device, i.e. a spaceship. It can be a natural Burgi bit thrown in an orbit which is totally, totally artificial in that it's been planned and carefully prescribed to convey these numbers.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I found with Elenine. Now, an awful lot of people got really, really mad at me. Really pissed off. How do I know? It's called email. It's called feedback from George a la Coast. It's called feedback through Facebook. It's called Facebook responses. It was really, really interesting how angry and negative an awful lot of people were at me that I said Elenine was special because of these numbers. I even did a presentation in, I think it was England, in Leeds, during the months before it was supposed to whip around the sun, and I laid out the major case of the conference there. People were really unhappy. Why? Because Elenine didn't do anything. Again, they missed the point. If there is a two-tiered American system, actually a global system, of people in the know, and then all the rest of us, colloquially it's been called now the 99% and the 1%, and it's actually much, much smaller than 1%. It's maybe 0.00001% of the people who really run the world.
Right.
And they're the ones who are doing this, then obviously, if they're only doing it for themselves to reinforce their own religious beliefs and cosmic leanings and understandings, it's like in any religion. If you're not in the religion, you watch a ceremony, you won't know what the heck is going on, right?
Right.
It won't have any significance to you. I mean, I was born and raised a Catholic. Well, if you're a Baptist and you walk into a Catholic church and you sit down, are you going to understand what's going on? Of course not. But at least you can walk into a Catholic church. What if there was a religion so secret because it's grounded in the physics of how to change reality, with a capital R, that it's kept secret by this tiny, tiny, tiny 0.01%, so that all the rest of us don't realize that we can democratize this physics and make it work for all of us? Because if we all knew that, then this tiny 0.01% would lose their control.
Right, right, right.
And so they keep it secret. And they make anybody who tries to blow the whistle on them look like an idiot for claiming something because, oh, it didn't do anything spectacular. Well, how naive can anybody believe that the sacred object of a secret, secret religion that's being manipulated by a secret, secret space program which has control of anti-gravity and can send spaceships out there and maneuver and nudge and manipulate an object, a Burgi bit, into a specifically, precisely defined ritual orbit is going to let anybody know what they're doing? They will celebrate when it hits its marks and goes through certain constellations and certain passages of celestial objects, which are, in their view, stand-ins for the gods, all in total secrecy. And if they're really cool, they'll make the whole thing appear to go away so nobody pays attention to it anymore, which is exactly what happened with Elenine.
All right, Richard, I'm going to pause you right there, and we're going to, of course, lead this up to ISON now in the second segment as we proceed here in a little bit. We're going to take a short break here, though, And as always, Richard, I was always a lot of questions for you, but I'll let you kind of lay this out first, of course, so we can get to some of those questions later. But please, before we take a short break here, Richard, give us the website for more info. And also, I just wanted to ask you briefly here then, are you planning to, do you have any paper or more material kind of upcoming on this and the numbers and everything?
I'm going to put something on the Enterprise Mission website in the next few days, now that ISON is beginning to perform as we've kind of hoped it would. And so enterprisemission.com, keep going there. I have two Facebook pages. I have my friends page and my fan page. Do they call it a fan page anymore? I don't know. And I'll be putting notices there to point people to the paper on the Enterprise website. And I may or may not be doing, shows on this with George, with Coast. But this one will be in the archive so people can go back and look, and we'll put a lot of information on the Red Ice page so that people only have to do one-stop shopping.
Indeed, indeed. Very good. Okay, enterprisemission.com, and check out Richard's Facebook as well. We'll take just a brief little break here. We'll be right back with more. Stay with us, Richard.
Tonight, and all
Second hour, more is coming up with Richard C. Hoagland. He'll talk more directly to the eyes on numerology and the esoteric occult subtextual signaling of the comet and the related events that are slated to take place in the next few months, including the upcoming Winter Olympics in Sochi, Russia, 2014. And we'll get into that interesting spacewalk that they did with the torch of the Olympics. But before we proceed, let me just say quickly here that we have Andreas Backmeyer on vaccine injuries coming up on the program. This is the only survey that's been done on the health of unvaccinated children. That's an interesting program. Then after this, we have Jesse Ventura on JFK and American politics. Judy Byington, John Whitehead, and many, many more are coming on after this. We'll proceed right now then with Richard Hoagland on Red Eyes Members. com. You can sign up for a subscription, support independent radio, and of course get full access to our archives, all past programs, and all the video material that we have there for you. We are working on some new stuff right now as well, insight episodes, in-depth research and analysis. Some good stuff is coming there, so keep your eye on that. Right, but we'll talk to you after the break. Thank you for listening.